I'm John Wells. I'm a reporter with the Hamilton Spectator, and this is the second in a series of podcasts called Newsroom Insider, where we speak with Hamilton Spectator journalists about what they do and how they do it. Today I'll be chatting with Spectator Editor-in-Chief Paul Burton. Paul will be talking about, who else, Donald Trump, and also sports. We'll also hear Joanna Freketich's interview with Deb Matthews, the Deputy Premier and Minister of Advanced Education and Skills Development, with respect to Joanna's continuing coverage of concerns raised over the salary structure of Mohawk College President Ron McCurley's contract. And we'll also be chatting with Spectator columnist Jeff Mahoney about a piece he has running in Saturday's paper, and Natalie Padden about what it's like to work the night shift at the Spectator. First up, Paul Burton. So, Paul, thanks for being with us again.
No problem.
Looking back on the week that was in the Spec, what stories or story jumps out at you as being notable?
Well, beyond the international stories, you know, we did some good work, the city's doing some good work around toxic cleanup in the city. So I found those stories interesting and hopeful. Another story I kind of like, just because it's personal to me, city also approved a plan to assess the city of Hamilton's urban forest and presumably with an eye to improving it. So, you know, they're going to do a study, which I think is good. And a lot of other human interest stories in a week that really didn't have a lot of big breaking news events.
Mm-hmm. Now, in tomorrow's paper, that is Saturday's paper, we're speaking on Friday. Saturday's paper has the latest in Joanna Freketich's coverage of the Ron McCurley story, the Mohawk president. Why do you think this story is important to tell?
You know, I think it's important to tell, not necessarily because of the details of this story, but because it's about transparency, and it is really, if you'll pardon me for plugging the media or journalism, it's the kind of thing that people wouldn't know unless we had people, reporters like Joanna, digging into it. You know, there's nothing necessarily wrong with it, except that what the college did was not transparent, and it went against what the intent of making those salaries public was, and so it the optics are not good. You know, whether or not the details of these expenses that you may read about in the paper tomorrow I'm sure it's all completely above board, but it just doesn't look good. And you know, why the college felt it necessary to do this end run around the legislation, you know, that's really the big question.
Hmm. And your column, your Saturday column this week, what's the what are you looking at this time?
Actually, it's it will have my byline on it, but it's very little of my writing. I reprinted a letter to the editor, which was critical of our sports coverage, and then simply reprinted the reply from our sports editor, Jeff Day. You know, there's a feeling among some of our readers, I mean, certainly not the majority of them, but that we do a poor job of sports coverage or entertainment coverage or whatever coverage. But when you examine that and put it under the microscope, you see that in fact we do an excellent job of all of those things. So Jeff responded to each of the questions that was raised, and it turned out, you know, we'd given those news items and those people who had made the news, we covered them all. So you know, some days were not perfect, but I just thought it was an example. I've sat in many a focus group watching people who say there's nothing to read in our paper, but when they're presented with the paper, they go, "Wow, this paper's full of news."
And sports readers, I remember hearing years ago an editor saying, I'm not sure if this is still the case, but you know, that the number of sports readers for the Spectator, they weren't the most voluminous readers we had compared to other parts of the paper, but those who do read sports were extremely passionate about everything that was in the sports section.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I think you could say that about any section of the paper. Oh. We have many, many readers who read the whole paper cover to cover, but a great many of our readers are reading it for one specific thing: the local news, the national news, the entertainment, the sports, the politics, the health news, the recipes, or the comics.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, certain readers looking for certain things. At the morning news meeting, I was at my desk, but I could hear some of the conversation from afar, and some of the talk was about Donald Trump, and if I understood correctly, you know, how much is too much, or if too much is ever enough, and I don't know, what's your approach on this? He's unprecedented in producing these continuous news cycles.
Yeah, I wrote about this, I believe, under the headline, "How Much Is Too Much," or, you know, "How Much Is Too Much Trump." It's an excellent question. A lot of our letter writers are saying they've had enough. Many are saying they have had not enough, or many more are saying, you know, bring it on. Mm-hmm. Some of our letter writers have said they're going to cancel their subscription if we don't stop printing these letters that are critical of Mr. President Trump.
Really?
And, you know, what? How does an editor react to that, other than send condolences? I'm sorry, but you know, we try to print the pro-Trump letters as much as the anti-Trump, and I know that we have a lot of Trump supporters among our readers. However, at least as the letters and submissions are coming into us, the anti-Trump submissions far outweigh the pro ones. As for covering the events of this week, how do we avoid that, really? He's not a normal president, and the United States is not just any other country. It's the biggest, most powerful country in the world, and it's our neighbor. We've never seen a president like him before, and for better or worse, in my opinion, worse, he's unleashing sentiments, either newly discovered or long simmering, among the population on both sides of the border, that do not bode well for the future of a just or peaceful society. And so you can see that now this week in Canada with the debate over M103 by the conservative leadership candidates, and you can see it just in the amount of inappropriateness or even hate on the internet, in our comments or on social media. And I think that I think that newspapers have a bigger role, journalism has a bigger role now than ever before in making sure that we hold our leaders to account and make sure they're giving us, everyone's welcome to their opinions, but we have to make sure that the information that is being disseminated is correct or stands up to scrutiny.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so I guess with Trump, it's to be continued.
Yes, it looks that way.
Thanks, Paul.
My pleasure.
Spectator reporter Joanna Frikatich has been covering the story about concerns raised over Mohawk President Ron McCurley's contract and the structure of his salary. In Saturday's paper, Joanna has the latest in a series of stories she's been writing on that. Here now is the entirety of her interview with Deb Matthews, the Ontario Deputy Premier and Minister of Advanced Education and Skills Development.
Hi, Minister Matthews. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
I wish I could say it's my pleasure. I'd be lying.
Yeah, well, thank you for the time. I wanted to ask you, we have now confirmed that Ron McCurley got a $17,000 raise through the foundation, and that was while executive compensation was frozen with the province. So I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, clearly that is not in the spirit of the compensation freeze.
Mm-hmm. And are there any rules against this? Against having separate contracts and salaries and expenses with the foundation?
Well, there certainly is the rule of common sense. There is the rule that that we expect people in the broader public sector to actually respect the direction given by government.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything you can do about this or are doing about this?
Well, I trust that they are going to do the right thing. I can tell you that I'm watching it closely.
And what would be the right thing?
Well, I think to respect the freeze, to respect full transparency, and to respect the spirit of the Sunshine Law.
And is there any way that that you could create a rule or change the act at all so that executives couldn't have a second salary and contract with through their family?
Yeah, Joanna, I'm not going there right now.
Mm-hmm.
I am watching carefully though, and hoping that the people do the right thing.
And do you know, are there other situations like this, or is this the only one like it you've found so far?
So we're still looking into that.
Mm-hmm. And does the same? What do you think about the idea of executives claiming expenses through the foundation? Do you see that as the same issue, or as a bit?
Well,
different?
No, I think that if those expenses are charged in the interest of the foundation, so that if somebody is entertaining a prospective donor or whatever, I think it's quite appropriate that that be covered by the foundation.
Mm-hmm. Even though the public wouldn't be able to see it or even be able to access it through Freedom of Information?
Well, I think the foundation is a separate entity, and I think as long as the expenses are being charged appropriately to the foundation, I don't have a problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
If it's for activities related to fundraising to the foundation.
Mm-hmm. And so it's only if it was activities related to fundraising for the foundation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And although a lot of what the presidents, from when I've talked to the presidents, there's a pretty fine line that a lot of them, part of their job at the hospital or at the college is to do work for the foundation. So where do you sort of draw the line there?
Well, I mean, we have to leave some room for their judgment.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's, I think the responsibility of the foundation is pretty clear, and that is to raise money, to invest money, to get private donors to contribute to the operations, then it's quite appropriate to charge an expense in that regard.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything else that you'd like the public to know about this, or anything else that you'd like to say about this?
Well, I think just what I said last week is, I fully expect the leaders in the broader public sector to adhere to both the spirit and the letter of the laws.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's great. Well, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Joanna. Take care.
So right now, I'm sitting down with Jeff Mahoney, a veteran columnist at The Spectator. Can I use the word veteran, Jeff?
Old is fine, too. Old. I can live with that.
Okay, good to hear.
Well, 28 years.
I was going to ask you how long you've been here. So 28 years. And you've been a columnist. Well, you've worn different hats at the paper.
I have. I've been a visual arts reporter. I've done lifestyle reporting. But for a large stretch of that, I've been a columnist of one kind or another.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking that I started The Spectator in 1997, so I'm coming up in 20 years.
Right.
And when I started, I remember Paul Wilson was here, a columnist. Mary Nolan was here. And Jeff Mahoney. To me, those were the big three.
Thank you, John.
The three best writers of the paper that I was inspired by. And so Jeff is my favorite writer at the paper.
Well, now I'm behind you on that list.
Well, I guess that's debatable. Perhaps for another time.
Mutual Admiration Society.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll just carry on with this. So you have a column appearing in the paper. When? Saturday?
I think it's going to run tomorrow.
So it's running on Saturday.
Barring any kind of breaking news that'll bump me off.
And that happens, right?
That does happen, yeah. It's happened. And so I try not to commit to people that the story's going to be in on a given day, but I tell them it should run, barring, as I say, 9/11 or a new Trump press conference.
it happens.
It happens.
Now, so the piece you've done for Saturday is about Ray Cunnington, who's a local author.
Yeah.
And it's in part a book review of sorts. You're writing about a book that Ray has written, and also about the man himself.
Exactly.
And the title of the book is Towards Less Adversarial Cultures.
Exactly.
So I guess first of all, you know, people often wonder how we come to write the stories we do. How did you come about meeting Ray and writing this piece?
Well, a reader whom I know was telling me about Ray Cunnington, and he's a fascinating man with a fascinating past in peace activism. And he's 96 years old now, though he looks preternaturally young. He's got this kind of Prince Valiant haircut, and he wears these paisley shirts, and he's just a very robust, energetic 96-year-old. But he's coming, I guess, to a point where he feels whatever he's been moving towards in his life, he wants to process. So he's written this book, and it's a very readable 90-page kind of miniature that really lays down a lot of interesting ideas and philosophies about peace and about culture and why peace seems so elusive and what we can do. But he's been working all of his life in one way or another towards this goal. And I mean, it slips away from him. He sees somebody like Trump become president, and he sees a world that seems to be coming more divided, at least in North America. But he takes it in stride, and he sees it as kind of cyclical. These things have happened before.
And the book, the book's been published.
Yes.
Is it available in stores?
I don't know that it's available in stores. With so much publishing these days, you order it through the internet, or you can call. I think it's available through the UN Culture of Peace group in Hamilton. So I will try to mention that in the article. I'll get more on that. But I think if readers or listeners to this podcast are intent on getting the book, they could call me up, or they could Google it by title.
So now, in terms of writing your column, you met Ray. You went to his place, or how did that? What'd you do?
I called up Ray and asked if we could sit down together. And of course, with all of these interviews, there are certain protocols you go through. You establish where you want to do it, in a coffee house, or if there's some obvious place to do it, if there's some physical activity where they have to be at a track or at an airport or whatever. But often it's in people's homes, so I can get a sense of where they live and their surroundings. That sometimes will help with the color for the story, or to give you an insight into the person and how they've organized their lives.
Now, when you're interviewing someone like Ray, and you write quite descriptively about him, like you do with everyone you write about, you know, describing his colorful paisley and purple bloom shirts and the white hair as you described and so on. Do you take notes on that as you're interviewing him, or is that something you would think about later as you're writing your story that comes back to you?
A lot of that stuff, which stays with you, you don't really have to write down. But I have a little scrawl on my notepad as I'm taking down stuff that Ray was saying, paisley shirt. And second time I saw him, he had this purple shirt. So he dresses kind of in this ornate way, which some might think is, you know, an older guy trying to be young. But with Ray, it really comes out of his personality, and you sort of have to know him and well, not that I know him per se, but you have to sort of soak him up to get that sense. But he's very genuine, very endearing kind of man.
And I guess that's, I know in the stories I write, and we all have to make decisions on what kind of description to use in a piece.
Exactly.
And when it's when it works for the story or doesn't, in terms of when do you choose to describe what the person's wearing or looks like or not, right?
Those are hard decisions to make because you have space limitations and you're trying to get in a lot of information. But I think there are also details that can really pull a reader into a story. Mm-hmm. Oh. I think sometimes people don't want to just read a long sort of litany of what the person has said, or this is what constitutes this person's story, A, B, C, D, E. They like to, I think they like to see the rhythm broken up a bit, maybe take a little pause from the narrative, and just as in a novel or a short story, you might interrupt the flow just to slow the reader's rhythms down so they can think about the physical appearance of a character.
Right. And are these things as you're writing your story, are you thinking about that, or are you at a stage now where, you're breaking it down for me now because I'm asking you about it.
Yeah.
Is it something that's just kind of coming naturally, or are you actually consciously thinking about that?
That's a great question. And these things tend to work their way into a story without you really consciously saying, well, here I needed some description. They just seem to come out of the flow of the writing process. Although with Ray, I sort of made a conscious decision before I actually sat down and started to write that I did want to address some of his physicality, because I think it's part of his character, and people I think people bring that to the experience of Ray Cunnington.
And he in the piece you talk about how he went to war, he served.
He did.
But not as a soldier, right?
No, and as he explains in the book a little bit, and as he explained to me in our conversation, the roots of his ideas about peace, a lot of them were formed early on, not even as he faced the prospect of being conscripted into the Second World War, but in boarding school in England, which sort of, as Ray describes, it conforms to all those pictures you've seen of very disciplined, that British stiff upper lip, the reserve and the rigidity. And he talks about corporal punishment, and he said it just didn't seem fair to him as a child that grown men were hitting children, which is what corporal punishment is. We have a culture where we sort of codify that kind of behavior as somehow being acceptable because it's sort of channeled this way, but it still amounts to that. So, and then he, of course, had to, without having much appetite for it, face the prospect of going to war and killing Germans whom he didn't know.
Yeah.
And so, war in the abstract seems, very understandable. Mm-hmm. I guess we extrapolate, somebody hits me, I'm going to hit them back. Or if we have a dispute over something that I think I should have, you have a fight. Mm-hmm. And that's acceptable. And I guess we extrapolate from that to international affairs where countries can have wars and have their young, used to be men, but now young women too, killed to defend these points of strategy or honor or possession. So these things, he just didn't see, look, why am I killing Germans? Mm-hmm. Now, think of Hitler and you think that's a noble cause, but I guess at the time, in a microscopic way, he had to decide, what's he going to do? Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, as you wrote, to kill someone, Nazi Germany, but to kill someone they hate, not someone they hate, but someone like them, maybe 19 years old, with whom they had no personal quarrel.
Yeah.
And that's the...
He was 19 years old when he had to make that decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I say the story that maybe a 19-year-old, maybe my daughter's 19 years old, I can't even imagine, or if you had a son, I can't imagine them having to face that, right? I can't imagine having to say goodbye to them if they went off to war, and it's just insane. But such is the way of the world, and that's what Ray's trying to change and address.
How many words are your columns generally?
Well, they're supposed to be about 650 words. This one's over, so when I finish this podcast, I'm going to try to trim it down a bit. But I don't think I can get it much under 750. So I have a bit of leeway. Sometimes if I really think a story is worth a bit more, they'll go for it. If there's it depends what space is available in the edition it's going to run in. So this one I got to trim down a bit.
That's right. And we're speaking. It's nearly 4 o'clock in the afternoon on Friday.
Exactly.
And I've read your column, but you're still polishing and you're still trying to make some trims where possible.
Exactly.
Is it daunting sometimes when you've? I mean, sometimes you'll interview a subject where the subject is small. I mean, you're taking something that's small and you're kind of blowing up larger in a sense.
For sure.
This guy's led this huge life, and he's going to write a book, and it's you could write a book about him.
Yeah.
But you've got your 650 words. Is that daunting to capitalize that in a column?
It is daunting, John, and I think you. I know you remember a few years ago where we could write a bit longer. There was more space. Mm-hmm. But it's a great exercise. It's a great discipline to see just how much you can take out of a story and make it still hold together. Mm-hmm. Because it's like building a building, and if you have to get it to a certain size, that might not be a good analogy. But there are times when I look at a story and it's not short enough. It doesn't meet the word count, and I'm thinking, I just can't take any more out of this. And usually you can. It's amazing, the whole process and how you hold a story in your head. And sometimes you hold it there, and it's perfect at 750 words. But there's a way to make it perfect at 650 words. It's going to be a slightly or somewhat different story. Mm-hmm. But it's good discipline. It's hard discipline, though, especially for, you know what it's like. You think every sentence you write is necessary and brilliant, and the readers really need to read it. But
yeah, some writing,
they've got to go.
Some writing teachers have talked about, you know, the you need to be able to kill your own.
Kill your own. That's
you know,
it.
You can get attached to a phrase or a sentence. Yeah. Maybe you love it, but maybe it's not.
Well, they say too, like even beyond that, they say find out what you love most about the story you've written. And get rid of it. That's not a hard and fast rule, but sometimes it is, because sometimes what you're most attached to is something that's maybe personal or maybe excessive or maybe only too meaningful to you, that you're too close to it and you've lost sight of it. And that can happen. So it's not a bad thing to keep in mind. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'd hate for Shakespeare to go back to some of his writing and think, well, I really like that to be or not to be speech, but I better cut it out because I like it too much.
I want to ask about your ending to the column.
Yeah.
You know, you, first of all, your second last paragraph, you referred to the timeliness of the book by quoting Ray, where he writes that, though democratically elected governments may be less willing to use violence than dictatorships, the act of casting ballots does not eliminate the possibility of putting someone ruthless in power. Ray may have been referring to Hitler there.
Yes.
But you're talking about the current climate, aren't you?
I'm trying to suggest that.
Yeah, without saying it outright.
Yeah, without saying it outright. And I'm not comparing Trump to Hitler, and I think it's a mistake too, although I can see why people do, because you have to wait until he does something that's horrible. By the same token, you don't want to let somebody go that far, not saying that he would.
Yeah.
But there are always problems with our democracy that we are really called upon to exercise the vigilance with people, even the ones who have been elected, so
and then the final line. I mean, I'm big. At least I try to be. I try to write effective endings to my stories, and you've done that here. You know, the last line of the piece. And I just want to ask you where this sort of came from. The last line, you write, you can see a beautiful rushing creek from his window. That's Ray's window. I ask him if it ever freezes. He says no. Tell me about that ending.
Do you like that ending?
I like that.
Because I've taken that out, but I think I'll put it back in.
After this, I want you to do that.
We're just talking about this, and then it's so interesting that was in the earlier version, which you printed out, and I've made some alterations to that, but maybe I will put it. What did it mean to you? Because I thought all of a sudden I'm bringing this Russian Creek in, and it's true. He has a beautiful view from his window onto a creek. And and today, when we were taking pictures and I was looking out, it's just a beautiful image of this water rolling over the rocks underneath the sun on a beautiful sunny morning. And yet it was cold out, and I was wondering if there's ever so much cold that it just freezes. And he says he's never seen it freeze over. And I thought it was a metaphor
a metaphor for,
I think,
for Ray?
For Ray, yes. Also for the search for peace. Like, there are going to be times when it seems hopeless. World War II must have been just the most hellish time to live through. And yet, somehow the human race got through it, maybe less for it, maybe damaged because of it for sure, but maybe some good things came out of the aftermath because people had to endure this horror. So the creek ran, the creek kept running, and I don't know if that's too obvious, but on your strength, I'm going to put it back in, and I'll see if I can take something else out.
Maybe we take a vote on the website from the readers as to whether the ending should live or die. But no, I took it. You know, the metaphor for Ray, he's 96.
Yeah.
Never staying still long after freeze over, and then also that, you know, when hell freezes over, in terms of the grander sweep of the piece and peace.
I wasn't even thinking of that, but that's a nice resonance.
So to me, I read that. I thought, you know, to me, it had that kind of like boom.
Great.
The end, you know. So.
Well, I'm going to put it back in.
Well, then our conversation has been worthwhile.
It sure has.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John. Thanks for the great questions and for understanding.
We'll do it again soon.
Okay.
Next, I'm chatting with Natalie Padden, who is a reporter at The Spectator. And Natalie, it's Friday afternoon. It's nearly 5 o'clock, and you're working a 2 to 10 p.m. shift, correct?
That's right.
How often do you do that evening shift?
Every Friday, every Monday, and then sometimes weekdays or weekends in between, depending on everybody else's availability.
What would you prefer? Do you like the evening shifts? I guess is the question.
I prefer the day shifts because with the evening shifts, it can be difficult to get a hold of people if you're trying to reach people who work in offices or businesses. But the evening shifts, you know, usually there's something happening, so they can be kind of exciting. Or if they're not, it's usually some good downtime to finish some stories that you might have been working on and not had a chance to get to.
So what do you, and sometimes, of course, you're getting... assign, you know, stories off the cuff, things are coming in, some of the things pan out, sometimes they don't. What are you sort of chipping away at right now that may or may not bear fruit?
Well, today we're looking at a 67-year-old man who fell in the ice in Dundas with warmer temperatures. Ice is getting thin. He was skating. Looking at how local food agencies are coping after Christmas with whether they have enough donations to feed people or whether they're running low. Also trying to finish a larger piece on tall buildings that I've been working on for probably about a month now, but it's one of those things that just keeps getting pushed aside to do other things. So
it's really keeping a lot of balls in the air, I guess, right? I mean, I was trying to get you in here for the interview and you had to go rush back to the phone, right? You're just getting stuff all the time, I guess.
Yeah, it was an officer from the Marine unit calling that about the story. So, you know, you always want to try and get people when they're getting back to you because it can be difficult, like I said, sometimes to get people on the phone. So.
Right. Certainly when I started The Spectator many moons ago, reporters, or a lot of reporters, had a beat. You know, they covered City Hall, they covered the courts, they covered crime, social issues, what have you. But nowadays, I guess, well, some reporters might have a certain expertise, but pretty much everyone's in the mix in terms of doing different covering different subject areas. Is there an area that you enjoy reporting on the most, or?
Well, up until recently, 3 days a week, I spent my time focusing strictly on local business. But that has shifted a little bit. So I am definitely interested in the business side of things, social justice issues. Honestly, just any good stories that come out of the Hamilton community. There is so much happening here, I think, that we don't always hear about or we don't always get a chance to write about. So the number of story ideas that come in from people in the community, it's always great to try and connect with them and to try and, you know, learn more about things that we might not have had a chance to yet.
Now you, how long have you been at the SPAC now? What'd you
say? This time, for about a year and a half, but I was here as an intern in 2013.
Right. So you're still, I guess, well, to me at least, one of the relatively newer faces in the newsroom. The SPAC has a few war horses in the newsroom, but it's also a good, you know, young crew of reporters, right? Where'd you go to school for journalism and so on?
I went to Western in London. Mm-hmm. The program actually no longer exists. It was the one-year...
The master's program?
Yeah, it was the one-year master's of arts in journalism, but now, I think it was 2 years after I graduated, or a year maybe, they changed it, so now it's a master's in journalism and communications, like a hybrid,
right.
I guess, to respond to the changing demands of the industry.
Interesting. Now, so we talked about the variety of stories that you do, mm-hmm. and the stories you're working on today and so on. In general terms, how do you come to do the stories you do? How do you decide what you're going to write about?
A lot of them are assigned by editors, stories that they come across or stories they think should be covered. Some of them are from folks in the community reaching out to me, either by email or by phone. Some of them are just the happenings of the community, you know, breaking news, fires, crashes, ice rescues. Others, yeah, you know, sometimes you might be out at an event covering something in particular that you've been assigned to, but, you know, through a conversation with someone else, you might be tipped off to something else that's happening in the community, something that maybe you want to pursue. So sort of a variety of different ways.
And you're looking back at the stories that you've covered this week, you've done a variety of things, as always. One of them was, the headline was, local midwifery community sees diverse clients. And the woman who you sort of profiled in the piece, Mona Abdel Fada, who's a midwife at the Hamilton Midwives on Houston Street South.
Yep.
And you wrote about how she was originally from Saudi Arabia and has learned her, or rather has used her knowledge of Arabic at that community and at that center. How did that story come about?
So Mona had reached out to us a couple weeks ago now about the vigil that was being held at City Hall to honor and support the mosque in Quebec, where there was the shooting and,
right.
and several people were killed. She had reached out to let us know about the vigil to see if we were going to be covering it. And in doing so, she had sort of offered a few sentences about Hamilton midwives, because they were going to be at the vigil, and about some of the work that they do. And in that, she mentioned that she is believed to be the only Arabic-speaking midwife in Hamilton, which was something that my editors and I found particularly interesting and unique. So we thought, you know, maybe tuck this away for a future story and hopefully be able to follow up on that more.
Did you interview her in person or over the phone, or what did you do that for that?
John Renison, photographer, and I went down to the clinic on Houston last Thursday, and we sat down in one of the rooms at the practice, and we shot some video, and he shot some photos, and I interviewed her there. So it was good to get to meet her in person and, you know, to be able to capture her on video, you know, telling her own story instead of just me regurgitating it in the paper. So.
Right. And you were working a day shift that day then, I guess, or not?
I was, yeah. Yes. Yeah, I was working a day shift, and we were actually trying to get it done on Thursday because I was working last weekend, and I was going to be writing the story on the weekend, but we wanted to get photo and video done ahead of time because sometimes weekends can be unpredictable, and you don't know if you'll have time to get that kind of thing done.
Now, did you have how tight was your window to write that story? How much time did you have to write that?
I'm trying to think back to last weekend. I didn't write it on Saturday. I wrote another story that I was working on. I might have started it late Saturday night, and then I started it when I came in Sunday, but things kind of got rejigged with other news that came up, so I ended up writing it mostly Sunday night, and then the story ran in the paper, I believe, on Tuesday this week.
And a couple of other stories you wrote this week. One was about the toxic barrels being cleaned up, and then there was another one. The headline was "Crash Victim Remembered as Beautiful Soul," about a 37-year-old woman who was killed in a car crash. Certainly, you know, working the two to ten shift and working a hard news shift like you often do. You're doing breaking news. How often, you know, in general terms, how often are you having to report on someone who has died tragically? I guess, I mean, it happens on occasion, right? How often does that happen?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes more often than you would like, obviously. You know, I would say probably it wouldn't be uncommon to do a story like this at least once a month, maybe, depending on time of year. You know, sometimes winter is worse for crashes because of the weather and conditions.
And so for that one, you know, from the story, you spoke with some family or people who knew her and so on. Is that what case where you were assigned that story and had to try to find people, I guess, to talk about who she was, right?
Yeah, well, actually, it was on the weekend. So I had written two Mondays ago now that there had been this crash on the QEW because I was working the evening shift on Monday. I had closed down the highway for a few hours, and that a Hamilton woman had been transported to hospital in critical condition. And so I did check back a couple times throughout the week with OPP to see how the woman was doing. And they kept saying, her condition hadn't changed. And then on Sunday, when I came in, I was working the afternoon shift on Sunday, we noticed a tweet from the OPP media relations person saying that this woman, who ended up being Catherine, who we wrote about, had died on Saturday night. So it was not really a case of being assigned the story because, well, as you know, but there aren't really editors actually here in the building so much on the weekend. They're available by phone and by email. So just saw the tweet and had to run with it and sort of make those calls. So started looking for family, but Canada 411 only had dated numbers. They were no longer in service, but through social media, we were able to find her partner. And as the afternoon went on, local agencies and organizations who Catherine had worked with started putting out their own messages. The band she was the lead singer of took to Facebook to express their sadness. So we were able to connect with a handful of folks who knew Catherine and knew her quite well, and they were able to speak about the impact that she had on them.
What's it like to get in touch with people and then speak to them about you know, a tragic death like that, and to have to get them talking? You know, it's your job, but what's that like?
Well, I was actually saying before I made the phone calls to a colleague that it doesn't ever seem to really get any easier to pick up the phone and cold call someone who you may think is a family member of a person who just recently passed. But at the same time, you know, you want to give people the opportunity to say something about their loved ones and maybe have them remembered in a way that is different than just being the victim of a crash, which was the case in this circumstance. And after I connected with Catherine's partner, Martin, I did feel glad that I had been able to connect and had been able to reach out, because he seemed grateful that I had done so. But, you know, there's always a risk that people aren't going to want to talk to you, which is completely understandable too.
Sure.
So it's always kind of that gamble. You're always sort of a bit nervous picking up the phone, not knowing what to expect.
Mm-hmm. How do you, you know, you go home at night after you've written a story like that, and you've sort of, you know, worked hard to hear the pain of people's voices and all that sort of thing, and then to write the story, capture her life, and now you leave. And now you're, that's it. You're, how do you detach from the emotion of that when you go home?
Yeah, it can be hard, especially in the case, in this case. I mean, listening to people talk about Catherine, she sounded like such a great person who had done so much for the community. And, you know, it makes you, in a way, it kind of makes you reevaluate and think about your own life. It makes you grateful for the time you have, and also just realize that, you know, your life can change in a split second. Sometimes by factors out of your control. So, it can be difficult to detach, because it's, to me, it's impossible to not let these stories affect you in any way. And I mean, hopefully, maybe that is a good thing, because maybe that can kind of be reflected in the story. You know, it's maybe less cold if you do genuinely feel the impact of. You know, what has happened, and really feel the words that the people you're interviewing are speaking to you.
Mm-hmm. That was a good piece.
Thanks.
Natalie, thanks for chatting with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.